If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This episode is brought to you by Twizzlers. Long day, late night, feeling a little bored? Twizzlers is the ultimate sidekick for any moment of the day, no matter what kind of day you're having. The perfect level of sweet and a fun excuse to sit back and relax. Unwind with Twizzlers. To buy now, visit Hersheyland.com/Twizzlers.
And welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine and BBC History Reveal. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. Spain's position on Europe's southwestern corner means that through history it's been exposed to influences like no other region on the continent. Giles Tremlett's new brief history, España, explores the many geographical, religious, and political factors that contribute to a many-layered story of a country whose defining national history is nearly impossible to pin down. He spoke to Eleanor Evans about getting to grips with Spain's tumultuous past.
So thanks so much, Giles, for joining the History Extra podcast again. And you introduced readers to this history with the idea that Spain has no national story that it can celebrate with comfort. Perhaps that's a good aspect to begin with here. What can you say about that?
Well, I always point to the Spanish national anthem as the proof of this. Anybody who's ever watched the Spanish football team La Roja before an important football match, and they've played many over the last decade or so, winning World Cups and European Cups, you'll get two teams lined up before a match. One team will belt out their national anthem with all its words, and the other team just hums along. And that's the Spanish team, which hums along because it has no national anthem except for a tune. And it has no national anthem because it's never managed to reach agreement over what the words would be. And we all know what national anthems are. They're sort of edulcorated versions of our history, and Spaniards can't actually come to an agreement about what that should look like, what the Spanish national narrative is. And we're still there. People try to write that the words to the national anthem from time to time, but it always fails.
Right. So as a writer, then, obviously, you've written on many aspects of Spanish history, on Isabella of Castile, on the Spanish Civil War. Telling this history, how is your approach different in this sort of account? What's your aim with this book?
Well, I'm really coming at it from sort of three angles that I don't think people necessarily think of when they're thinking of Spain. One is simply to do with geography, with its position, on the atlas, if you like. Spain is this very strange country. If you think about it, it's just, a dozen miles across the Strait of Gibraltar from Africa. So it's the closest European country to Africa, and that's had a huge impact on it. Obviously, it's part of Europe at the same time, but it's also part of the Mediterranean, which connects it all the way over to the Middle East, historically. And then if you stick on to the map, the circular winds and currents of the Atlantic Ocean, well, hey presto, Spain is also, or Iberia at least, is also connected to the American continent. That's how, Columbus was able to, in quotes, discover the Americas. So, that means that it's been over its entire history, the different currents have flowed into Spain from different directions of peoples or of cultures, and that's made Spain a very mixed country, if you want, with lots of influences that other countries in Europe wouldn't possibly have had. Whether we're thinking about the Islamic invasion of the 8th century, for example, parts of southern Italy maybe might have experienced something similar, and, Eastern Europe. But to have that and to have the Atlantic input and to have the European input and to have the Mediterranean input really makes it a sort of mixing pot. So that's one of my ideas, is that it's a mixing pot, and that mixing pot has inevitably brought this sort of what in Spanish we call mestizaje, which literally is to mix things up. And that means it's actually been a very sort of dynamic culture, very changeable over the years, which might also explain why it's more difficult to explain and to actually have a national narrative. So first of all, it's geography, which includes the fact that actually Spain is this very impenetrable country. People who visit it now go to the coasts mainly, but mostly, I'm sitting in Madrid as we speak. I'm, in the highest capital in Europe outside, I think, Andorra. This is a country that's mostly built on top of a sort of massive mountain top. And then we have the coasts, and we have these two very different Spains, the interior and the exterior. And so that's very different. And then finally, all that sort of comes together. There are moments when Spain is very open to all these things, and there are moments where Spain sort of seizes up and closes itself off from the world. Francoism was a bit like that. You can go back to the Inquisition and think of it in those terms, or to the expulsion of Jews and Muslims.
Yes. So all of those factors, I think we'll dive into in this conversation. But I wanted to also ask about this idea of the four winds, which is Miguel de Unamuno. Is that correctly pronounced? Can we talk about this idea and how that influenced Spain?
OK, so Miguel de Unamuno was a philosopher at the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century, very important person in Spanish intellectual history. And he really embraced this idea, what he called the four winds. And it's slightly what I was explaining earlier, the idea that Spain is exposed to these sort of cultural, political winds that blow in from all directions, from Europe, from Africa, from the Atlantic, from the Mediterranean. And when it's open to all those things, Spain lives through glorious periods of progress. And when it's closed to all those things, historically, it's gone, if not backwards, at least stood still in time. And Unamuno, who was talking at the end of the 19th century, when Spain was in crisis because it had lost its empire and was lagging behind the rest of Europe, well, he sort of he crystallized or at least vocalized this idea that, you know, open Spain is good, closed Spain is bad. He was very pro-European. We're now living through a massively pro-European period in Spanish history. And we've done very well, thank you, for the last, you know, 40 years.
Okay, so that's a great sense of how the geographical position has influenced Spain very broadly through history. How does it influence the earliest aspects of Spanish history, Iberian history?
Well, if we go back to the sort of prehistory, then we get everything from, you know, the period of what's known as the Zanclian Deluge, when the Strait of Gibraltar actually dried up, and, you know, you could walk across from Africa, and different periods in the Ice Ages, for example, when you could sort of island hop across. And indeed in the Ice Ages, when Iberia was a sort of refuge for species and hominins from around Europe, because it wasn't iced over when the rest of Europe was. And then when we get into early history, well, we've got this sort of magnificent mixture of everything from Romans, Visigoths, Phoenicians, Carthaginians, Byzantine colonies, Greek colonies, Jewish colonies. And so that, again, is Spain sort of open to all these different influences from the Mediterranean. You know, Hannibal starts off his career in Spain. This is where the elephants came from in the first place. And so Spain is part of this sort of zone of contact, shall we say, between Europe and the other cultures. And in fact, is very privileged at one stage when Europe is going through its so-called Dark Ages. Well, Spain has all the glories of Al-Andalus, of its Muslim period. Culturally, it is way ahead of the rest of Europe at that stage. So that sort of early history of Spain is full of these different flows, shall we say, cultural flows coming in from different directions, and you know, not only impacting Spain but also impacting the rest of Europe. If we think, you know, Hannibal marching north with his elephants was an important moment. Well, there it is. If we think of some Roman emperors, well, you know, Britain has Hadrian's Wall, and guess where Hadrian came from? He was Spanish. So, you know, Britain actually has, you know, a Spanish wall, if you want, you know, across the north. So Spain has had a large impact, often not really recognized because it was part of the Roman Empire, really. And one of the things I try to correct a bit in my writing is this idea that Spain has been a sort of outlier country in Europe. I don't think it has. I think it's been incredibly influential. We just tend to look at other countries more intensely.
Yes, well, that idea did really come across for me, I must say. And listeners listening to you talk about this history may be familiar with the more difficult aspects, I suppose. And this melting pot that you've already alluded to does lead to some really challenging aspects of this history, doesn't it? With waves of religious fanaticism and ideas of religious purity. How do we see that sort of playing out over the centuries you're writing about?
Well, this really, I mean, there are waves of religious fanaticism even within Al-Andalus, within the Muslim history of Spain, which, of course, lasted for 781 years, I think, if we add up, you know, the years from the invasion in the 8th century to the fall of Granada in 1492. I mean, that's, if you think of it in historic terms, if we were to think back into British English history, we'd have to say, you know, that's a period that covers from today back to the Wars of the Roses. It's a vast stretch of time. Granada, which fell in 1492 to the Christians, well, it still hasn't been Christian for as long as it was Muslim before that. You know, we still got a few decades to go. So that's, you know, a very important period. But then, of course, we get into the period that starts with Isabel of Castile and Ferdinand of Aragon. I've written about Isabel as well, which is one of these moments where Spain has a massive impact on the world. But within its own territory, it turns in on itself and it decides to go for this sort of wave of purity, which involves expelling the Jews, which happens in 1492. It involves bringing in the Inquisition, which also happens under Isabel, and the Inquisition and the expulsion are very intimately linked. It involves forcibly converting the Muslims in Spain, and then a century later expelling their descendants because they're deemed not to be properly converted. So we have this sort of violent and oppressive period in Spanish history. The Inquisition, by the way, is always sort of overplayed by non-Spanish historians. In fact, far fewer people died in the Inquisition and died from, say, Protestant witch hunts in the rest of Europe. But what matters is the idea that the Inquisition imposed on Spain, this very strict Catholic doctrine, and the idea that really, you know, it was dangerous to think outside your small mental and cultural space. So that was, you know, a very violent and disturbing period. Some Spaniards, you know, still think of it as a glorious period because it also coincides with other events that happened under Isabel. So yes, that's one of those examples of what I call closed Spain turning in on itself.
Right. Well, you just alluded to it there, is that in the same period, the Spain, I suppose, geographically as we know it today, sort of begins to emerge. What's at play there in Isabella and Ferdinand's reign that brings these regions more closely together?
Well, I mean, several things are happening. First of all, Isabel and Ferdinand are Castile and Aragon. And when those two bits of Spain come together, they basically create Spain. They're the two halves of Spain, which are brought together by their marriage, and then under their children and grandchildren become, if not a single country, and that's one of the things Spaniards love to argue over, when they actually became a country rather than a collection of countries under one monarch. But anyway, we can say that process started with them. And of course, they're the people who send Columbus again in that same year, 1492, out into the ocean. It wasn't called the Atlantic, it was just called the ocean back then, you know, to sail west and to find Asia. And off he sets, you know, lying to his crew about how long this might take and how far they've gone. And he bumps into a group of islands that he thinks are Asia, but in fact they're the Caribbean. He's, you know, discovered the Americas, and, you know, Spanish history after that for many centuries is largely about becoming an empire.
Very broadly, I suppose, this does kick off sort of five centuries of Spanish imperial history. Whereabouts in South America and in Central America is Spanish influence reaching?
Well, Spanish influence reaches, to start with, it reaches the Caribbean, and then it gets into Mexico, and we have, you know, the ghastly conquest of the Aztec and Inca empires as they go south, and the whole of the continent falls to Spanish invaders. The conquistadores, as they're known, the conquistadors, who again in Spanish mythology do all this on their own, just a few thousand people who, you know, the phrase, you know, to burn your boats actually comes from Hernán Cortés, you know, reaching the coast of mainland South America and burning his boats, literally, so that his men can't turn round, and there's only a few thousand of them, and somehow miraculously they conquer a continent. In fact, what they do is they ally very cleverly with various factions and a politically very clever, but also totally ruthless in their treatment of the of what today we would call the Mexicans to begin with. No, so very quickly they take possession of a continent. Doesn't mean they control it all. There aren't enough of them, but it does mean that in sort of European terms, it now belongs to Spain, apart from the little bit that by mistake gets given to Portugal.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
I remember, as I was a journalist at the time, going to the first exhumations of mass graves from the Francoist period. And I would go, and a couple of other foreign correspondents would go, but no Spanish press would turn up.
This episode is brought to you by Twizzlers. Long day, late night, feeling a little bored? Twizzlers is the ultimate sidekick for any moment of the day, no matter what kind of day you're having. The perfect level of sweet and a fun excuse to sit back and relax. Unwind with Twizzlers. To buy now, visit Hersheyland.com/Twizzlers.
So a moment there in history that obviously has a long legacy. I want to pick up on something you mentioned about mythologies and this mythology one that has sprung up around Cortés's actions. Well, you begin some chapters to references to mythical or apocryphal stories that come to symbolise or perhaps become cornerstones of what was happening in Spain or Iberia at the time. Can we talk about that phenomenon and some other of Spain's prevailing mythologies?
Yes, well, Spain often, like other countries, you know, tells itself stories to try and sort of weave this impossible narrative that we've been talking about. If we go back in time, it's Hercules is the great founding myth of Spain. This is where, you know, many of his 12 labors are happening. The Straits of Gibraltar are meant to have been created by him, sort of accidentally pushing a hole in the wall and joining the Mediterranean to the Atlantic. Mythical stories going through. They also tell, for example, there's an explanation for the Muslim invasion of Spain, which is to do with a Visigoth king, one of the last Christian king who breaks a taboo by opening the door to a secret chamber, whereas, you know, all the previous kings had just added another lock. And then you also get mythologies then used at the end of the medieval period, in the early modern period, to try and basically erase the Muslim history of Spain and sort of do a jump between the Visigothic Christians and the newly Christianized Spain of Isabel and Ferdinand. And that involves, again, going back to Hercules and trying to trace, you know, a sort of direct lineage back from those monarchies. So in a way, that's been Spain's attempt to sort of, you know, to iron out the perceived kinks in its history, is to invent stories, as we all do. All nations have done that, and Spain is certainly no exception.
But if we skip ahead then to sort of the beginning of the decline of this imperial presence, which inevitably again changes the face of Spain and leads to a lot more internal divisions, which, you know, arguably have been bubbling away over those centuries anyway, what can you tell our listeners about that, this sort of phenomenon?
Well, in the 19th century, Spain, well, the 18th and 19th century, Spain sort of gets into trouble, basically. It's lived, in very simple terms, it's lived off the fat of the land, not its own land. It's lived off an extractive economy in Latin America, bringing in lots of silver, basically, to prop up its own economy and spending wildly on its wars around Europe. It's always fighting over bits of Italy, which it controls for a long period, and over Holland, which it also owns and controls for a long period. And it uses up a lot of the money there, and it takes loans, it gets into debt and defaults and becomes bankrupt. And but there's a sort of an economy evolves where between Spain and Latin America, where also they have a market of their own, which only they can sell into, which is Latin America, and all that sort of works quite well until we get to the early 19th century, when Spain has switched to a Bourbon monarchy. The old Habsburg monarchy runs out of fuel as it becomes more inbred, and eventually it's so inbred that it can't have any more children. Charles II is the last Habsburg king. And then it basically gets tied into France and French history. Napoleon appears at the end of the 19th century. He's sort of invited in, but it's sort of invasion by invitation, if you want, to begin with. And then ordinary Spaniards turn against Bonaparte and the Bonaparte family, because Napoleon actually appoints his brother to be the monarch of Spain. And so ordinary Spaniards turn against this, and Madrid, and every May we have this. This is our city fiesta in Madrid, is to remember how in 1802, on May the 2nd, the people of Madrid turned against the French, attacked them in the streets, and basically started what we know as the Peninsular Wars. The Peninsular Wars to us is Wellington and everything, all the battles he won in Spain. But to Spaniards, it's actually their war of national liberation. And in fact, I argue that really it's the moment where Spain is properly created, where for the first time you see Catalans and Galicians and Basques and Andalus and everybody all fighting on the same side for the same thing, which is to free themselves from the French with the help of Wellington and the English. At the same time, they're writing a very liberal constitution, far more advanced and progressive than anything that Britain, for example, had seen. And certainly, apart from France, which had already had a revolution, it was much more progressive than anywhere else. Unfortunately, it then invites back the monarch who had been ousted by Bonaparte, Ferdinand VII, who was known as the desired one because everybody wanted him to come back. Well, he came back immediately, threw the constitution in the dustbin, chucked out the people who had written it, and imposed a sort of new authoritarian monarchy. But the Spanish colonies, the Spanish Empire, had experienced this moment of sort of people's freedom during that period as well. And suddenly they turned around and looked at what was happening in Spain and said, well, we're out of here, basically. And very quickly, over, a dozen years, Simón Bolívar and other liberators in Latin America basically shake off the Spanish yoke. It happens over a very short period of time and is far more dramatic than what happens in North America, around the same period or a bit earlier. So, within the space of a few years, Spain loses its empire. It's left with Cuba, Puerto Rico, and the Philippines. That's all that's left. And then at the end of the 19th century, it even loses them. And it loses them to the Americans. This new power turns up, the United States, with its fleets. The Spaniards have sort of duped themselves into believing they're still a mighty global power, and they're basically, you know, shot out of the water in a, you know, in a single morning in both cases, once in Manila and once in Cuba in 1898. And that's the sort of the foundational trauma, if you want, of contemporary Spain, is that moment where they suddenly go, oh, no, you know, here we are, this once mighty empire reduced to nothing. You know, we are only now, you know, a European country. We have no empire, and especially hurt at a time when Britain and other countries were gaining empires. You know, the race for Africa was going on, and Spain, you know, experienced this moment of sort of acute introspection and sort of national, almost a period where everybody is glum, and you can see it in the intellectuals at the time. They're all asking, you know, what's gone wrong? What's happened to Spain? Where did we go wrong?
So if we play this sense of collective trauma forward, then what does that mean for Spain in the early 20th century?
Well, we're still at it. We're still trying to work out how to deal with that part of Spanish history. And so the Franco dictatorship ended in 1975. 40 years, Spain had a single story about its past that was taught at schools, that was printed in the newspapers, that was told on the television, that was told on the radio. But at the same time, a lot of people knew that it was rubbish, basically. But in 1975, it's also has this remarkable transition to democracy, which happens over 5 years, basically. Franco, when he dies, declares that Spain is going to become a monarchy again. And basically, Juan Carlos II, now a somewhat disgraced former monarch, but anyway, he receives all the powers of a dictator and gives them all up to initiate a democracy. And that democracy takes off, but it's also very fragile. People are very worried that there will be a coup, that people want to go back to Francoism. And so a lot of things that could have been done, and one of those is addressing history or indeed trying to bring some form of justice to the families or the people who had been repressed by Franco and by his regime, that was all sort of swept under the carpet. The important thing was to look forward, to consolidate. And indeed, there was a coup attempt in 1981. So it wasn't this was a very real threat and it was seen off. But after that, it still took a long time, not until the end of the 20th century, really, for people to start properly investigating Francoism. And I'm not talking about the historians who were already doing that, but for it to appear in the public sphere, in newspapers. I remember, as I was a journalist at the time, going to the first exhumations of mass graves from the Francoist period. And I would go, and a couple of other foreign correspondents would go, but no Spanish press would turn up. And it was because, people were scared of the past. They were scared of their own history. And they were scared that revealing it would suddenly bring back all the old arguments and we would go back to the old violence as well, that it would spark another civil war. In fact, that hasn't happened, and all those arguments are out there. And to me, that's a sign of the maturity of Spanish democracy, that you can have the old arguments, but without everybody wanting to get into a fight or starting to kill one another. But what it does mean is we haven't reached any agreement. And so we are still arguing about how that past should be treated. Should the monuments be taken down? Should the old streets be renamed? Should the people who, the people who belong to the death squad, should they be named? Is there some route through the courts for people to demand justice for things that happened to them even in the 1970s. You know, some of the perpetrators are still around. And Spain has largely tried not to do that. I think in the hope that everybody will die before, everyone who's involved will die before you get to that point. And you get these sort of bizarre situations where Spain is trying historic crimes against humanity in Latin America. It's taking the Pinochet regime to court, but it has an amnesty law in Spain, which was passed in the 1970s, which means it can't do the same to its own dictatorship. And one of the great ironies is that now the families of the victims are taking their cases to Argentina on the basis that under international law, you have a right for your case to be heard anywhere else if it can't be heard at home, if it's a human rights case. So there's a lot of arguing over history going on. And personally, I think that's quite healthy. I think we should be arguing over history, especially as we can without without killing one another. But it also means that the old fractures of the 1930s, Catalonia, for example, or the Basque Country, that they're also out in the open. And, you know, they've reemerged and we're arguing about those things too. But again, I think that's natural. You know, we went through an exceptional period, two exceptional periods. One was dictatorship, where you couldn't debate anything. One was straight after the dictatorship, when nobody wanted to debate certain things. And now we're back to reality. And this is what Spain is like. You know, it's a fractious country, likes a good old argument. And if it can have it, you know, passionately but safely in Parliament or in the newspaper columns, that's fine. Why not? You know, that's democracy. And in the meantime, you know, Spain has done very well, thank you very much, from, you know, belonging to the European Union. The last decade or so hasn't been that great, but it hasn't been for anybody in Europe particularly. And, you know, who knows what the future will bring.
That was Giles Tremlett. His latest book, España, A Brief History of Spain, is published by Head of Zeus and is out now. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Brittany Colley.